So Haridas is very old. With my tongue I shall chant your holy name, Sri Krishna Chaitanya. That is my desire. Let me give up my body in this way. O most merciful Lord, if by your mercy it is possible, kindly grant my desire. Let this low-born body fall down before you. You can make possible this perfection of all my desires. Mahaprabhu then said, my dear Haridas, Krishna is so merciful that he must execute whatever you wish. But whatever happiness is mine is all due to your association. It is not befitting for you to go away and leave me aside. Catching the lotus feet of Mahaprabhu, Haridas said, my Lord, do not create an illusion. Although I am so fallen, you must certainly show me this mercy. My Lord, there are many respectable personalities, millions of devotees who are fit to sit on my head. They are all helpful in your pastimes. My Lord, if an insignificant insect like me dies, what is the loss? If an ant dies, where is the loss to the material world? My Lord, you are always affectionate to your devotees. I am just an imitation devotee, but nevertheless, I wish that you will fulfill my desire. That is my expectation. Because he had to perform his noon duties, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu got up to leave. But it was settled that the following day, after he saw Lord Jagannath, he would return and visit Haridas. After embracing him, Mahaprabhu left to perform his noon duties and went to the sea to take his bath. The next morning, after visiting Jagannath temple, Mahaprabhu, accompanied by all his devotees, came quickly to see Haridas. Mahaprabhu and the other devotees came before Haridas, who offered his respects to the lotus feet of Mahaprabhu and all the Vaishnavas. Mahaprabhu inquired, my dear Haridas, what is the news? Haridas replied, my Lord, whatever mercy you can bestow upon me. Upon hearing this, Mahaprabhu immediately began a great congregational chanting of the holy name in the courtyard. Vakreshwara Pandit was the chief dancer. Headed by Srila Damodara Goswami, all the devotees of Mahaprabhu surrounded Haridas and began the congregational chanting. In front of all the devotees like Ramananda and Sarvabhauma, Mahaprabhu began to describe the holy attributes of Haridas Thakur. As he described the transcendental attributes of Haridas Thakur, Mahaprabhu seemed to possess five mouths. The more he described, the more his great happiness increased. After hearing of the transcendental qualities of Haridas Thakur, all the devotees present were struck with wonder. They all offered their respectful obeisances to the lotus feet of Haridas Thakur. Haridas Thakur made Mahaprabhu sit down in front of him, and then he fixed his eyes like two bumblebees on the lotus face of the Lord. He held the Lord's feet on his heart, and then took the dust of the feet of all the devotees present and put it on his head. He began to chant the holy name of Sri Krishna Chaitanya again and again. As he drank the sweetness of the face of the Lord, tears constantly glided down from his eyes. While chanting the holy name of Sri Krishna Chaitanya, he gave up the air of life and he left his body. Seeing the wonderful disappearance of Haridas Thakur by his own will, which was just like that of a great mystic yogi, everyone remembered the passing of Grandfather Bhishma. There was a tumultuous noise as they all chanted the holy name of Hari and Krishna. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu became overwhelmed in ecstatic love. The Lord raised the body of Haridas, placed it on his lap. Then he began to dance in the courtyard in great ecstatic love. Because of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's ecstatic love, all the devotees were helpless. And in ecstatic love, they also began to dance and chant congregationally. Mahaprabhu danced for some time. Then Sri Damodara informed him of other rituals for the body of Haridas. The body of Haridas was then raised onto a carrier that resembled an airship and taken to the sea, accompanied by the congregational chanting. Mahaprabhu danced in front of the procession. Vakreshwara Pandit, along with the other devotees, chanted and danced behind him. Mahaprabhu bathed the body of Haridas in the sea and then declared that from this day on, this sea has become a great pilgrimage site. So when you visit Haridas Thakur Samadhi in Puri, you have to try and find the sea. It used to be right there, but unfortunately now there are 25 hotels built all around it. You get on the other side of the hotel, there's a road. You get on the other side of the road, you finally get to the ocean. But in those days, and even up till 15 years ago, 20 years ago, you would come out of the door of Haridas Thakur Samadhi, and it was just the sand dunes and the grass, and you just went through the ocean. So it doesn't look anything like that now. It looks more like, I hate to say it, but it looks like Miami Beach, someplace on the Riviera. But nonetheless, that sea at that place is a pilgrimage place for the devotees of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. So when you go there, you also go after it and try to swim in the ocean there, have ocean bath. From this day on, this sea has become a great pilgrimage site. Everyone drank the water that had touched the lotus feet of Haridas Thakur, and then they smeared the remnants of Lord Jagannath's sandalwood pulp over the body of Haridas. After the samadhi pit was dug in the sand, the body of Haridas was placed. Remnants of Lord Jagannath, such as his silken robe, sandalwood pulp, food, and other such articles, were placed on the body of Haridas. All around the body, the devotees performed congregational chanting, and Vrakeshwar Pandit danced in great jubilation. Vrakeshwar Pandit's name is mentioned quite a few times in this gospel. With his transcendental hands, Mahaprabhu personally covered the body of Haridas with sand and chanted, Hari Bol, Hari Bol. They covered the body of Haridas with sand and then constructed a platform upon that site. The platform was protected all around by a fencing. And several hundred years later, when now there's a samadhi, there's a building around it, there's a temple and so forth. But in the time of Bhaktivinoda Thakur, his bhajan kutir was just a few meters away, 50 or 60 meters away. Bhaktivinoda Thakur used to spend quite a bit of time doing his bhajan at the side of Haridas Thakur Samadhi, and I think it was 1874, the year of Bhaktisiddhanta's birth. Maybe I'm wrong, but it is at the Samadhi of Haridas where Bhaktivinoda wrote, he reasons ill to say that Vaishnavas die, and thou art living still and sound. The Vaishnavas die to live, and living spread the holy life around. The famous couplet, as you call it, poem written by Bhaktivinoda at the place of Haridas. He reasons ill who say that Vaishnavas die. But generally we don't use this word die in relation to a Vaishnava. So many living entities are dying. But when a Vaishnava passes away from this world, generally we don't use this word as a die. That is the Tirubhava. Tiru means beautiful, and bhava, that is an expression of love. So actually, Tirubhava means their transition from this mortal world to the land of love. It is beautiful, it is wonderful. It is not like the death of a family member or unfortunate situation like that. It is a transition from this treacherous land, mortal world, to the land of love, Tirubhava. So Bhaktivinoda Thakur says, he reasons ill to say that Vaishnavas die when thou art living still and sound. So that living still and sound means that first there are two things, Vani and Vapu. Vani and Vapu. Vani means sound, as in the form of instructions. And Vapu means this body is Vapu, form. So when the Vaishnava is no longer mortally present, his Vapu cannot be seen. His form cannot be seen. But his Vani continues to manifest. So also in relation to Haridas, we must consider that he is present wherever the holy name is being chanted. Because that was his main instruction, chanting of the holy name by his own example of non-bhajan. When there is the pure chanting of the holy name, we may find many great personalities of the Supreme Lord may manifest there. At least I have heard about it on various occasions. The Panchatattvas manifest, Haridas Thakur has manifest, Goswamis have manifest. Many of the Lord's eternal associates will manifest where the pure kirtan of the holy name of Krishna or the pure japa of the holy name of Krishna is manifest. Now, where the impure kirtan is manifest and where the impure japa is manifest, what manifests? Kama, what is it? Kama Kamini Petition. This is what manifests. Material desire, aspiration for wealth, all these things manifest where impure kirtan is gone. So the Pauri Maharaj once said, by Vaishnava Aparad, a person often gets great wealth. Generally, people say, oh, we got a lot of money, that's Krishna's mercy. That will be determined how you spend it. And money is also the result of Aparad. Traditionally, almost every pure devotee of Krishna, since the sun came in the universe, traditionally, almost everyone has been poor, not rich. Poor. Most of the great temples you see in India were not built by pure devotees of Krishna. They were built by lusty kings trying to purify themselves. Like that king in Tanjore, so he won't be a worm in his mustache. He's some sort of a devotee. Yes, he was a Shaivite. But maybe this Krishna Deva Roy, he's not a Mahabhagavat. He built all these Gopurams. He's the one that started all this big Gopuram business even. Huh? Not the, there were, of course, Kulashekar in ancient times. There have been some kings. Naturally, they were. Kulashekar gave up his wealth. He didn't live like a king. He lived like a servant in Ramana. So, well, we're looking at these houses this morning all over and comment, big bungalows, huh? And I was telling Maharaj, everybody wants to live in a palace. They want to live like a king. Then I laughed, we're also looking to live like a king. We need a palace in Indira Nagar. We can't just take some humble man's bungalow. We need some 5-bedroom, big hall, floors. Otherwise, what happens? Well, nobody comes there. Nobody wants to be there. Sometimes we can't, devotees don't even like to be there in this age sometimes. But the reason we take some big establishment is for propagation mode. Govindji Gardens was not created to attract people. Now, it attracts people. People come there. Thousands come on Janmashtami. You've seen it. They come every year now, 2,000, 3,000, 4,000, whatever it is. It's a few thousand at least. About 300 people come a month. But originally it was just made to be a place where a few householders would live, have some cows, a little brahmacharya ashram, and it was just basically a farming settlement in South India, originally. Now it's something different. And that's why we built everything simple. The brahmacharis have it's supposed to be an 8x10 house, but they're all a different size. That's why it's like that. Because it's not to attract anybody. If you go and live in a big palace and chant Hare Krishna, you'll spend half your time looking at the pillars. Ooh, costly curtains. Nice marble carving. Is this Italian marble? That's how you chant Hare Krishna. Then you'll see this office, vice president, assistant vice president, secretary to the assistant vice president, all these placards on the door. Then you'll see one empty door and you'll think, this could be my office. My name could be there. Huh? You go there and open the door, it's the broom closet. Then there are no more positions. Then you think, I can get this man's position. In time, he'll go down, I'll make a rumor about his wife, I'll spoil his position, I'll take his seat. This goes on all the time in temples, politics. Same time, if there's not big temples, mostly people don't come. It takes centuries before people come to a small temple. Have you ever seen Gurupi Krishna temple? It's not any bigger than this downstairs of this house. Very small. So after 800 years, people come there. If you just make a small temple like that, here, just give a quarter acre and make a small temple. You cannot get many people to come. So the devotees will take a greater standard of opulence, build big temples and these things in order to attract people. But the problem comes that we attract that type of devotee also. He wants to join. Now somebody said the other day, nobody joins us because our mood isn't right, or something. There was a few criticism because our mood isn't right. So I guess Sai Baba's got the mood, yeah? Sai Baba, Babaville, he's got the mood. Because there's more people at Babaville than are over here at Rajaji Nagar, at Hare Krishna. And in time of Prabhupada, I tried to find the names of 10 men in India who joined Prabhupada and took initiation. And Prabhupada in India, I could not think of 10 people from India. Two. From India, like Kiridakshai Vishnu, he was living in London, and Gopal Krishna Swami was living in New York, and Audrey Dharam was living somewhere. So many people living outside, they joined. But just in India, they joined Prabhupada. I can't find 10. So I guess he didn't have Prabhupada mood. Because nobody came. Nobody joined. Nobody joined. Once I made a devotee in Delhi from the university, he was from a Brahmin family in Bengal. Must have been at least a little wealthy, otherwise how's he going to Delhi University? I went there one day and just sat down. I had a motorcycle, parked my motorcycle, sat down, started chanting. A few people walked by. Then I opened Bhagavad Gita, 3 or 4 people sat down. I started speaking. They got up and left. One guy was sitting here. Then within 3 days, he left the college. He moved into temple in Delhi, Lajpat Nagar. That was a house not as nice as this house, even. Nothing like this. Old style. Another one with cement, small windows, claustrophobic, low ceiling, very, like that. Not a bungalow, just a house. He moved in there. Then about 2 weeks later, Srila Prabhupada came. In that 2 weeks, he's in the temple 2 weeks. He was given first and second initiation. In 2 weeks, he got first and second initiation. Because it was such a big deal that someone from a decent family with an education would join the movement. So I did the fire sacrifice, and Prabhupada gave him initiation. Then the GBCs came and said, he's from Bengal. If he comes to Mayapur, then that will give some prestige in the preaching in Calcutta and Mayapur. There was nobody there. The all prestige of Prabhupada's movement in India was one thing. Can you tell me what it was? The color of my finger. Foreigners. That was the prestige of the whole movement. Because there were foreigners, people became members. Because there were foreigners, people came to the temple. Because there were foreigners. Then, because there was foreign money. Because there was foreign money, Juhu was built, Vrindavan was built, Mayapur was built, everything got built. In Prabhupada's time, none of that existed. In Prabhupada's time, there was no milk in the temples in India. No milk. No milk. Nobody would drink buffalo milk. So there was no milk. Nobody had milk. There was no yogurt and there was no milk. There was no ghee either. Things were very, very poor. So, as I said, I guess he didn't have Prabhupada mood. So if the habit is to judge the success of Krishna consciousness by wealth and all these things, then we may find ourselves in the end very, very far from the lotus feet of Mahaprabhu. These are not the things to judge success in any way. I'm sure if you go to that place, everybody shaved this morning by 4 o'clock. There's not a whisker to be found on the nose of any man there, on the chin of any man there. Because Krishna consciousness is a shaved head and a shaved face. Nice shape, and fresh kurta, put some gold buttons, this is Krishna consciousness. And over here, we are too poor to buy razor blades, as we don't have the right mood. Understand? I had the mood at least not to throw my guru out of his temple. I had the mood never to criticize my guru one day in my life. I had the mood to wake up every day and serve my guru until I dropped. Whether I was young, middle-aged, or growing old, whether I was sick, or whether I was in fine health, I did the most that I could every day. And I found that to be the mood of my guru. That's the same thing he did. served his guru with every breath that he could in his life, whenever he could, according to his circumstances, as much as he could. And without coming in the line of this group of servitors, there is no question to enter the mood of Prabhupada, to enter the mood of Bhaktisiddhanta, to enter the mood of Bhakti Vinod, or anywhere in our parampara. There's no question to actually enter the mood. To imitate things, anybody can take money and go to a printing press and say, print a book. Anyone can imitate that and sell that book and say, this is Prabhupada's mood. But Prabhupada's mood was not to throw out his guru. Prabhupada's mood was not to reject the will of his society and all these things and to act independently. This was not his will. You understand? Anyway, I don't spend much time on that. So, great was it. Remember this point. If you want to read it, it's in that book, The Heart of Krishna. Great wealth is often the result of Vaishnava Aparad. Another thing which is the result of Vaishnava Aparad is interest in yajna, homa, and archana. It doesn't mean we shouldn't do those things. But it means that the interest is in those things and not in nambhajan, not in sadhu sangha, not in bhagavat katha. These are the things of the gopis. Nambhajan, the holy name, sankirtan nambhajan, Vaishnav sangha, Vaishnav seva. These things are the traits. And this bhagavat philosophy. And every day the bhagavatam class doesn't mean just to sit down in front of the book and just read from the book. It needs to be entered into the book, the Bhagavatam, the transcendental literature. There are many mysteries of the Bhagavatam. There are many people that read it for their whole life and never know what it's about. Many scholars that study the Bhagavatam never know what it's about. Millions of people in India read the Bhagavad Gita but never know what it's really about. Even big, big scholars. Within the paramparas, you expect to find the real understanding. The various measurements to understand the reality of any particular thing. So, to assure ourselves success, we are supposed to stay close to our guru. We are supposed to ascertain whether we are willing to accept our guru before we're initiated, not after. You don't marriage, and then after 3 years of marriage, decide, well, you know, I don't know if I can live with this lady. I don't know if I can live with this man. That goes on. That is not the standard. If the world takes up that standard, the children don't even know who their mothers and fathers are. It becomes so crazy. The world becomes greatly imbalanced. So, we're supposed to ascertain, okay, what is guru, all these things, can I accept the guru? And if we accept the guru, at that time, we're not supposed to then go to a path of criticizing, doubting, questioning, and all these things. We're just state close. If we figure that, well, actually we picked the wrong guru, well then that's a choice we'll have to make. And do whatever we think. And if we're wrong, and we did have the right guru, and we reject our guru, well, then we're in a bad position. But even if you think you got the wrong guru, that is not a hasty decision to leave the guru. Don't take that decision overnight. You'll find yourself into hell. There are many things involved between Krishna, guru, and disciple. The law of Shastra is, you know, law means the advice of Shastra is stay close to your guru. It is said that even if he chastises you, insults you, or beats you, never leave his instruction. That much faith is required. Whatever he tells you to do, follow that faithfully and see the result. Don't try to judge it. That's the advice of the Shastra. Then we can know the depth of all things in reality and Krishna consciousness. So Haridas Thakur, then the next thing in that verse is, we read in Gil who stayed at Vaishnava's side and thou art living still inside. And he found that Vaishnava's died to live. And also, Bhaktivinoda Thakur, he chose these words, died to live. These are words from a German philosopher named Hegel. Hegel. And Bhaktivinoda Thakur studied all these different philosophies. So died to live means in one side, means the death of the ego. But to finish this big ego, I am, hummamati, I mean mine. I did this, I'm giving a lecture, I, all these I's, they're to be retired. I did this, mine, me. Hummamati is called. George Harrison wrote his biography, it's called I, Me, and Mine. He took it from that, hummamati, I, Me, and Mine. We learn like that. This ego that I am the doer, I am the sender, everything is for me, everything is mine, this has to be abolished. Somehow we have to allow that to die. And then we can live in the proper plane of consciousness. Die to live. Ego must die, ahankara must die, in order for the pure ego of the soul to come. I am a servant of Krishna. It's very easy to repeat that. A child can repeat that. It's very easy to repeat that. A bhakta, a new devotee can repeat that. But then can we actually live that? I am the servant of Krishna. Or am I claiming to be the servant of Krishna, but actually I'm the servant of so many other things before I'm the servant of Krishna? Prabhupada left his family at one point because his family would not cooperate in Krishna consciousness. That wasn't a spot decision in the sense that it took a long time, nearly 20 years, to manifest. But in the end, he found that I cannot serve my Guru Maharaj in this situation. I cannot serve my eternal master in this situation. And Prabhupada's father had sold his Bhagavatam. I'm sorry, Prabhupada's wife sold his Bhagavatam to get tea biscuits. And when he came to know about that, he said, tea or me? And she said, well, of course, I could never give up tea. And the next day, Prabhupada packed his bags and he left. And he walked out the door and he stopped and he said, I'm going. And his wife said, have a nice trip. And he never went home again. After a few weeks, his son came chasing after him to try to patch up the whole thing. And Prabhupada engaged him in typing manuscripts for a book that he was writing for preaching in Genesis. And actually he didn't go back. He did set money aside for his wife, however. When he was successful in his mission, he set up a trust so that in her old age she would not be in difficulty or suffer and would not think bitterly. But that's such a big decision. Everybody will beat you, ridicule you. Nowadays what happens, devotees leave their wives, wife leaves their husband, but they're not to take sannyas, to get married again, after the age of 50. Many of my godbrothers, again they're getting married and maybe starting a family at 52 years of age. Or they're just getting married and just living together. At 50, the men are supposed to be looking about renunciation, not about engagement. Engagement is for the 20s. Marriage is to be performed in the 20s, latest. One young brahmachari, I told you the story, he asked Prabhupada about marriage. Prabhupada said, what's his age? He said, 30. Prabhupada said, 30? Tell him to forget it. It's too late. Marriage at 30 is too late. Do the math. You're having children over a period of 4, 5, and 6 years. So your marriage is 30. So let's say you're 36, you have your last child or something. Add 20 to that. You're 56, and you've got a 20-year-old son or daughter to deal with. Believe me, at age 56, you don't want to deal with that stuff. What to speak of when you're 60? Some people marry when they're 40, having children. They're in their 60s and they got a teenage daughter. It's not the science of life. We should be taking care of your teenage sons and teenage daughters when you're in your 40s. You're grown up, you see them married, then you enter your 50s and 60s. Not true. Life is not for them. Life is a science. When to marry, when to enter renunciation mode. Anyway, people do like that. The reason I was mentioning with that is people would actually, they stop to think, they would judge Srila Prabhupada as very extreme. As very extreme. It was very extreme. They would judge him. And somehow or another, they've made an icon. Icon? Icon means? Everybody's selling Jai Prabhupada, Jai Prabhupada, Jai Prabhupada, right? They're not listening to what Prabhupada did, and they're not paying attention to what he did. They're not listening to what he said, they're not paying attention to what he did. But they are giving, as Srila Sridhar Maharaj said, lip service to his name. Like in Christianity, Jai Jesus. I'm doing Jai Jesus. Amen, Jesus, right? And they're not following Jesus, even in the smallest thing. So, some will say, hey, oh, but they're following Prabhupada. Yeah, let's see in 100 years what they're doing. I'm sure they followed Jesus in the beginning too. Now, so long later, nothing to do with Jesus. This Jesus movement, almost zero to do with Jesus in the teaching of Jesus. So if we stay close to our guru and the parampara, then we have the best chance to avoid the maya and actually live our life in the mood of our previous acharya and previous acharyas. But without being close to your guru and without listening to his words, without following as an example, then you can become a pukka Hindu at best. And you know what? There is no such thing as Hindu. That word doesn't even exist in Sanskrit. It's a Persian word, which means the people that live on the eastern side of the Indus River. So in that way, anyone born in Pakistan, he's also a Hindu, because he also lives near the Indus River. He's also a Hindu. It was Indus. Indus, and the word became Hindus. But there is no such thing. There is no word Hindu in the Puranas, Mahabharata, Ramayana. Nowhere. Vedanta. Nowhere the word Hindu. Understand? So if we don't follow our guru, we become a Hindu. Become a hodgepodge. That's the most important thing. There isn't a second thing. And I say this not based on I found 50 verses to support it. I base this based on my own experience, what I saw. What I did myself, and what I saw. And what pleased Srila Prabhupada, and what didn't please him. And I saw so many scholars, so many people with so many qualifications, go away from Prabhupada. In his living time and after. They had great qualifications in many ways. But they did not have the qualification of simply being an obedient servant, accepting the order of the Guru, and giving their all in all to follow that order every day of their life. That simple thing they didn't have. But many other qualifications they had. The very great lectures. Arachitananda Swami. This guy could lecture like just control 10,000 people like children playing with toys. Completely control them. Right? But he could not follow the basic order of Sri Prabhupada. Basic things. Could not be obedient to the order of the Guru. And there have been many others, not to mention names. Then after the Sankirtan, Mahaprabhu bathed himself in the sea with his devotees, swimming and playing in the water in great jubilation. After circumambulating the tomb of Haridas, Mahaprabhu went to the Simhadwara gate of Lord Jagannath, and the whole city chanted in congregation. Mahaprabhu then spread a cloth and began to beg prasadam from shopkeepers. He said, I am begging prasadam for the honor, the festival honoring the passing away of Haridas Thakur. Please give me alms. Hearing this, all the shopkeepers immediately came forward with big baskets of prasadam, which they jubilantly delivered to Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. So since then till now, this has been a tradition in Gaudiya Vaishnavism on the Tirubhav and Haridas Thakur and all other great Vaishnavas. The day is observed by distribution of prasadam to devotees. So regardless of your situation, whether you're in a big temple, a small temple, even on the road sometimes, devotees right now, many are traveling. Unfortunately, in the world, some devotees will pass the day. They don't realize what day it is because they're busy doing sankirtan in some foreign country or something. But those that know, you'll find that they'll get powdered milk, sweet rice, even in the most difficult circumstances, they'll make some little extra prasadam on that day. And honor that prasadam, remember Haridas Thakur. You follow. So given the situation that Krishna has given us, we should certainly not be neglectful. Just in the name of busy, we cannot neglect those things which are essential in Krishna consciousness. And it's not just the getting up early, just the chanting. These are two of the two most essential things in the terms of, okay, you're a faithful devotee of your guru and Krishna Mahaprabhu, but then what is after that, what does it come to? The first thing is wake up early. The next thing is chanting of the holy name. The next thing is hearing some harikatha. The fourth thing, and this of course in association with devotees, the fourth thing is then honoring some prasadam. These are the four things. Done early, not lately, early. These things are to be done early. If a devotee can do these things every day, then the rest of the day is easy to deal with and easy to manage, no matter what it is. Any amount of obstacle, any amount of difficulty, any amount of maya even may come. If in the morning these things are done, you'll be strong to face the day in the service of Guru, Krishna, and the Vaishnava. There are very few devotees who did that in the morning and then blew it at noon. They usually gave up the night before, woke up that morning, didn't chant, didn't do the things, and then went to work. If again they just woke up and did that, even if it would be more like just a regiment, like the army marches, you know, then that actually would give them some benefit, and probably it would give them some hope. We give up the holy name of Krishna. We give up hearing about Krishna, Krishna's devotees. We give up honoring prasadam. We give up that early morning. Then we're like finding ourselves in the zoo, but inside the tiger's cage. And if you were in the tiger's cage, then you may be God. Huh? That's for the assurance of our safety in this world. These things should be seen through very carefully every morning. And then some mornings can't do everything, then what is the thing that you hang on the most? The beads. The beads are the most important. So when there are four men in the temple, everybody's hanging on the beads, then there's no cooking. Nothing is going on. So one of the four will then sacrifice the beads and go for the cooking. Now, we have a lot of problems. I mean, problems, things to work out. I suggested to the Maharajas here that they take Prabhupada's path and in relation to adjusting some of the difficulties. And this is something that never happened in the West, but was in every single temple in the time of Srila Bhaktisiddhanta and in the time of Srila Prabhupada. Up to a few years ago, it's still current in a lot of ISKCON temples in India. And what is that? That is to hire people to do certain services in the temple. In the time of Prabhupada, all the cooks in all his temples in India were hired. There were both good and bad experiences. But nonetheless, from Bombay to Mayapur, and still in Mayapur, and other places, you'll find that the cooks are hired. Similarly, there are drivers. Devotees generally don't drive their own cars. That's a rare new thing. This ashram needs some drivers to drive the devotees where they're going. You understand? So I suggest, I don't know if that will work out that way. The hardest one, I've hired cooks for my Sankirtan party in Jaipur, cooks for my Sankirtan party in Indore and other places. It's really hard to get the right one. A Brahmin cook who has some principle in his life, who's not a thief, all these things, it's really hard to do. But I suggest that it may have to be that way in order to fulfill the things. Right now, Mukund is Mukunda. Mukunda is going to his house soon. Then the cook will have to become Vrindavan Chandra, and he has to go to his work, or it has to become you. You're in your house, you have to come here. You know, the ashram has certain things to work out. So I've suggested that is a possibility. And I'm saying it now so that nobody in everybody's ear, in every single one of Srila Prabhupada's temples in India, from Vrindavan to Bombay to Mayapur to Hyderabad, all over, the cooks were always hired. So that the devotees, and in Vrindavan, there was a problem for preaching, because three big altars, and the biggest puja in India began in Vrindavan. Remember, in Istana, it began in Vrindavan. But it was such a thing. Six artis, 18 artis a day. There were three altars, six artis, 18 artis a day. 18 trays are offered a day. And 18 bulbs a day. 18 plates are made. All this, it was very, very difficult. Hired cook was there, and then there was a little devotee kitchen we called the deity kitchen. And what's his name? Bibhu Chaitanya, who's retired now, he was the cook there in the deity kitchen. But there was a problem. The devotees couldn't go preaching, because they couldn't go preaching, they couldn't collect money. So it was a very difficult time. And Prabhupada looked at the budget and how the money was being spent, and then he asked, I said, well, devotees need toothpaste. He said, brush your teeth with mud. He said, you like Radhakund, use Radhakund mud. It was a little sarcastic mood that day. Devotees used to like to wear black Radhakund mud ball beads on their neck. The Prabhupada said, use that mud to brush your teeth. Toothpaste only came in India 15 years ago. Before, there was a red and black powder we called monkey pod. Still, it's in all the villages. There were no toothbrushes in India 25 years ago. Everybody brushed their teeth with either a datun, which is a stick, using eucalyptus or neem, or your trusty index finger. Prabhupada never used a toothbrush in his life. Devotees have even been arrested climbing up trees in parks in the Western country, chopping off limbs. And in all the markets, now you can't find. You go to the subject market, there's no sticks. You would just go every day, every market in all of India, there are bundles of eucalyptus. And it was very, very, hygienic, actually. You take the stick and wash it. You chew on the end of it. And if it's eucalyptus or neem, the juice from the bark is antiseptic in terms of teeth decay. It kills bacteria. You chew the end of the stick until it's fibrous, and then you use it like a little brush. Then you split the stick and bend it and use it as a stomacher, and then you throw it away. Go to your toothbrush, wherever it is, get it and take it to a laboratory and look at it under a microscope and go, ah! There are things crawling around in your toothbrush. They got teeth as big as your little finger. Monsters crawling around on your toothbrush. But you can't see them because they're microscopic. So a toothbrush should be washed thoroughly before you put it in your mouth. Otherwise, it is a disease. In the family toothbrush rack, you've got all the toothbrushes sitting there, and all the germs from everybody's just jumping around. And we wonder why in family life the kids are always sick, dad's got a runny nose, mom's got a cough. It's all going like that. But when you live hygienically, all that stuff gets more reduced. But anyway, why did I tell you about the toothbrush? Oh, yeah, there were no toothbrushes. And there was no toothpaste. They said, brush your teeth with mud. Then, finally, the solution was there's no money because the devotees don't have time to go out. They couldn't go out because they had to do the pujari work. Then Prabhupada says, then hire pujaris. Krishna Balaram Temple, you've seen it, you know how big it is. He was ready to hire pujaris and put them on the altar. The devotees at that point felt so bad, they thought, no. Prabhupada said, you can hire anything except a preacher. But the devotees figured they could manage it. So they managed it, and he managed to get a sankirtan party going out, and devotees continuing the puja and things like that. They managed. But the cooks were almost always hired throughout. So we'll observe the other part of this morning by taking prasadam later. Something special will be prepared in Haridas.org, offered before the time. In the busyness of our day, everyone should remember what this day is in terms of the intent of Haridas.org. Any questions, comments?